Well, good afternoon. I'm very honored and thankful to be able to be here. It's actually just today. I flew in this morning, and I'm flying out this evening, which is kind of a waste because I live in Chicago, and so the temperature of this room is indicative of Chicago. So it would be a shame. I probably won't be outside a whole lot in this perfect 70-degree weather, but I'll have to go back tonight for, you know, just to, my son's a high school student. I don't need to say any more about need to being home as much as possible with a high school student at home. So thank you for coming to this time together. I'm going to open us in a quick word of prayer, and then I want to talk about what the next hour is going to look like for us. God, thank you for this wonderful work that you're doing through the Wesleyan denomination and the work of the gathering of educational institutions. Thank you that you have given us the gift of knowledge and the gift of wisdom and the gift of seeking after your work and your will. We pray for greater discernment and a greater understanding of what you are doing in our world so that we might be more effective servants in this world. We pray this in your name. Amen. My name is Hung-Chan Ra. I'm on the faculty at North Park Theological Seminary. I've been there now for 13 years. Which is a bit of a surprise because I thought I'd be there for about a year and then I would leave. But now it's been 13 years. Before that, I was a pastor, and I was a pastor and campus minister at MIT, as well as a church planter. Worked in a lot of different things within the church. I was a youth pastor, senior citizens minister, associate pastor, senior pastor, church planner. The only thing I have not done is children's ministry, and I have actually no desire to do children's ministry. Bless those of you who've done children's ministry. I just can't do it. But it's I bring today a kind of a combination of different experiences. First in the church as a pastor and as a seminary student and as a campus minister. So kind of being on the other side of it as someone working within the congregations. But again, for the last 13 years, being in the academic world, training pastors in the seminary and also at a Christian university. I've had the chance to speak at some of the schools in the network. Indiana Wesleyan is a school that I was able to visit this past year or so. So I want to talk today about a practical theology that addresses the concerns that are being raised right now as theological education, Christian education, higher education is undergoing some significant changes and challenges. So the way I'm going to approach this practical theology is using the work of Elton Villafañe, who is a Christian ethicist who taught, was my professor at Gordon Conwell Seminary up in New England. And Elton draws from the work of Holland and Henrio, who are Catholic theologians in Chicago, actually. And Elton develops a three-step process by which we develop a practical theology that speaks to a changing context. And the three categories he uses are clarification, conceptualization, and confrontation. I'll outline those three very quickly. I will warn you that we will not get to the third section because we don't have that much time, but I wanted to outline for you those three categories, but talk about the first two so that the third category is something that you can discuss within the community here. The first step is clarification, which is simply trying to understand the context of the ministry that we're doing. So if we're going to be a practical ministry and deal in practical ministry, we have to understand what's going on in the world around us. Holland and Henrio call this social analysis. What is happening in our world? What is changing? What is the context of our reality? The demographics of the group that we're ministering to? The social context of the group that we're ministering to? So that step of clarification is trying to understand the changing world that we're living in right now. The second step is, again, none of these are like better than the other or more important than the other. These are all important steps. And they're not necessarily in kind of an order as well. But the second step or the second category is conceptualization. And here we're trying to understand what is a theological way of understanding the world around us. What is the theology that we bring? Usually when I teach this class on social analysis and evangelism, what I say is I'm not asking you to develop new theologies per se or develop new like kind of off-the-wall theologies. What I'm asking you to do is to tap into the rich resource of theology that you have. Most of you come from various or specific theological traditions. And so you tap into those roots. You tap into that heritage. You tap into that very rich biblical theological heritage. And you begin to see how that theology, those theological concepts, apply to the world that you're living in. So it's not creating theology to speak to a changing world. It is tapping into the depth of your theology to make it more applicable to a changing world. Does that make sense? You see the differentiation. So that's the second process of conceptualization. What are the theological concepts that speak to the world that is around us and the world that is changing? The final step, or the final category, is confrontation. Now, what do we do about it? How do we take that wonderful theology, which sometimes is up here? As many of you know, if you've had seminary education, you know some of our theological engagement is way up here, but the problems are down here. We're at the 30,000 foot level, flying across the whole perimeter, but then down here is where the problems are. Confrontation is making the two come together. How does our theology speak to our context? And what are the practical, ministerial methods and practices and the things that we can actually do to serve the context that we're in? But we're doing it with our theological concepts. We are not just randomly coming up with ideas. We're actually applying our theology, a practical theology that speaks to the world around us. So what is unique about this as a Christian is to say we don't want to just come up with ideas just because they're good ideas for the context. We want to come up with biblical ideas, theological ideas. We want to come up with application that draws from our Christian spiritual heritage rather than just kind of pulling things out of the air. And of course, no church does that. No community ever does that. What I'm asking for is a theological reflection that says, what is going on in the world around us? Clarification. What are the theological truths that speak to that world? Conceptualization. And what can we do in very practical ways to apply our theology to our context? Confrontation. Like I said, we're going to get to the first two. The confrontation piece, I'm going to leave up to you to process together. That's what boards are supposed to do. But I want to give you the first two categories, tools, so that when you have that conversation about what are we going to do, you're being informed out of truth, out of scripture, out of theological reflection, rather than just kind of coming up with ideas on your own. So let's start with clarification. What is going on in the world around us? And I want to do this by looking at two very large trends in Christianity in the world today. The first, of course, is the global Christianity trend. Now, most of you are probably familiar with this. This is going to be a review, so I might move through that fairly quickly. If you want additional resources on the changes in global Christianity, there are some excellent authors. Dana Robert of Boston University. What's that? Dana Robert, R-O-B-E-R-T, of Boston University, has done some great work on this. She is one of the foremost scholars on global Christianity. A person who just passed away, I think yesterday, Laman Saneh, S-A-N-N-E-H. He was a professor at Yale Divinity School. He passed away at the age of 67. He's actually an African theologian who was a Muslim convert to Christianity. And he writes about the fantastic changes that are occurring throughout the world. The more accessible work I'll refer to in a little bit is probably Philip Jenkins' work, The Next Christendom. And so those are kind of some authors that might be helpful. Andrew Walls is another author. What I'm trying to point out is that this topic has been covered fairly well by historians and theologians and missiologists. And what it looks like is the question that Dana Roberts asks. And Dana Roberts asks, who was the typical Christian in the year 1950? If you got all the Christians in the world together and you picked out one person and said, this person represents Christianity in the world, you would say it's probably a 50-year-old white male, upper middle class, living in an affluent Midwestern suburb. That would actually be the tip, except for maybe the guy in the lower right-hand corner. That's Larry the Cable Guy. So aside from that, the idea of a typical Christian in the 1950s, all over the world, you take out one person, you could actually say a white male, approximately 50 years old, living in an upper middle class neighborhood in an American U.S. suburb. That would be your typical Christian in the year 1950. The question we want to ask, and I need to update this slide because we are now in 2019, but no major changes in the last 7 days. In the year 2019 or in the year 2018, who is the typical Christian? If you got all the Christians in the world together and you said, let's pick out one or two faces, maybe three faces, of who is the typical Christian, it actually would no longer be white male, approximately 50 years old, upper middle class in a U.S. suburb. In fact, you would say it is a Nigerian peasant woman in Lagos, Nigeria. It would be a teenager in Mexico City. It would be a university student in Seoul, South Korea. The major change from 1950 to the 21st century is that over a 50 to 60, 70-year period of time, we have seen a drastic, dramatic shift in what is the center of Christianity, in who represents the dominant majority and demographic center of Christianity. It is no longer a Western European or a North American phenomenon. It is, in fact, an overwhelmingly global phenomenon. Now, again, most of you already know this. Most of you are very much aware of what is going on in terms of global Christianity, that we have shifted from a North American, Western European Christianity to a much more Africa, Asia, and Latin American Christianity. This is a quote from Philip Jenkins. He talks about for 500 years, from 1500 to 2000, the story of Christianity was bound up with European and North American identity, and that the overwhelming majority of Christians lived in Europe and North America, and you can talk about kind of a European civilization. The shift, of course, in the past century, and that's in the 20th century, is that the center of gravity has shifted away from Europe and North America towards Africa, Asia, and North America, and now in the new century, the 21st century, the vast majority of believers will be neither white, nor European, nor Euro-American. Barrett and Johnson, who've kind of exhaustively studied the numbers of Christians in the world, pointed out that if you were in the 1900s, year 1900, to take a pinpoint and put it in the demographic center of Christianity in the world, it would have been right in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean, right there, because most of the Christians were living in North America and in Western Europe. Right now, if you were to take that pin and say, what is the demographic population center of Christianity in the world, it would actually be right outside of Timbuktu, Africa. And every week, you would step one step southward and one step eastward, because that's how quickly the demographic center continues to move away from North America and Europe towards Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Here are some numbers that back that up as well. In the year 1900, 68% of the Christians in the world were found on the continent of Europe. That's a pretty significant percentage, very high percentage. You can see Africa and Asia made up only a small percentage of Christians in the world. Now, the 20th century is a massive boom for Christianity throughout the world. And by the turn of the millennium, about 100 years later, give or take, you see the explosion of Christianity in Africa, to go from 2% of the world Christian population to almost 20%, Asia as well, 4% to 17%. You see Europe kind of falling off the map here, going from 68% down to 26%. So I'm generalizing here, and I have these in quotation marks, but if you were to say that Europe, North America, and Oceania, meaning Australia, is mostly white, then 83% of the Christians in the world in the year 1900 would have been of European descent. And only 16% would have been of non-European descent. By 100 years later, about 2000, 2005, you see already the number has flipped dramatically. So that by the turn of the millennium, you already had a strong majority of Christians be of non-European descent. So you see again, Europe kind of falls off the map, but Africa, Asia, and Latin America spikes and skyrockets in terms of Christian population or makeup of the Christian population throughout the world. The projection is that by 2050, Africa will be about 30%. Now, these numbers are actually changing, and they're grading these numbers up, actually, saying it's probably more than 30%. Asia is going to be 20%. Europe, again, went from 68% down to 16%. So that, again, the non-white continents of Africa, Asia, and Latin America will be about 71% of the global Christian population. Now, I want to add a caveat here, because I said have the word in quotation marks. European Christianity, even though it's declined and down to 16%, if you visit Europe, the growing Christian communities in Europe are actually non-white. The fastest growing church in Stockholm, Sweden, is an African church. The largest church in Kiev is actually pastored by a Nigerian. In Paris, the fastest growing churches are African churches. So when we say white and not, and I'm going to get to the North American numbers in a minute as well, but if we're saying white and non-white, that number actually of non-white Christians is probably more like 80 to 85%, not 71%. That's just looking at general continent trends. But this is about 80 to 85%. Now think with me then, if in the year 1900, 80 to 85% of the Christians in the world were white, by the year 2050, 80 to 85% of the Christians in the world are non-white, and this number held for about 1,500 years of church history. So for 1,500 years of church history, you had a dominance of those of European descent, 80 to 85% of the world Christian population. And in 150 years, in 1/10 of the time, the numbers have completely flipped over in 10% of the time that it took to establish this number in 150 years. It overturned 1,500 years of church history. This is, and we are smack dab in the middle of that reality. So global Christianity has seen remarkable, drastic, dramatic changes over the last 100 years and will continue to see it for the next 50 years. Yes?
Are you aware why Latin America is projected to fall off?
Yeah, this is interesting because these numbers are interesting because some of it is what we would call kind of growth, and some of it is also proportional growth. So part of the European decline is twofold. One, you're getting a decline in European Christianity and decline in North American Christianity. But you're also getting a larger population boom, right? So the absolute number of Christians here is larger than the absolute number of Christians here. So even if Latin America is relatively flat from 24 to 22, the number of Christians could actually be higher, would actually be higher. But it's because Africa and Asia, those numbers are absolutely booming, that it looks like Latin American Christianity is in decline. But it, you know, if you looked at the raw numbers, it would actually be a little bit higher. You know, it's still growing, but when you compare it to Africa and Asia, it maybe not be as growing as fastly. Now, one of the things I track here is, as a church growth, someone who studies church growth, is looking at the 10 largest churches in the world. What is the largest church in the United States, by the way? It's kind of disputed right now, but there are two churches that are considered the two largest churches in the U.S. Anybody guess? One's in Oklahoma.
Life Church,
yes. And the second is in Texas, Houston. Yes, Lakewood. Yeah, it's always funny because nobody says Lakewood, the name of the church. Everybody says Joel Osteen's church. So these two churches are 1 and 1A right now. Lakewood has about 50,000 worshipers on a typical Sunday. And they're meeting at the former Houston Rockets Arena. They packed that thing out. Life Church is interesting because they have about 15 actual sites, but multiple internet participants. I believe the last numbers that I heard, and actually Life Church is in my denomination, the Covenant Church. I believe the last numbers I heard is that it has 35,000 physical participants if you add up all the campuses, and about 15,000 internet participants. So if you add the internet participants, Lakewood and Life Church are about the same, about 50,000 participants in the church. Where do they rank in some of the largest churches in the world? Are they in the top 10? Not even close. What is? I think it's still the case. What is the largest church in the world right now? It's been for a while. Yes, at Seoul, Youngi Cho's, well, he's kind of retired now. Full Gospel Church. At its height, it was estimated there were 1 million members. It's lower than that now, but at its height, it was 1 million people. And I actually visited the church 2 summers ago, and I'm part of a denomination that kind of prides itself on not declining over the last several decades. The Evangelical Covenant Church is one of the few evangelical denominations that has actually grown over the last 10, 15, 20 years. We're at about 300,000 members total. So we're one of the growing denominations. We're at about 300,000 total, which means that our denomination as a whole is a third of the size of one church in Korea. So let's put some of these things into perspective. So 4 of the largest churches in the world are actually in Korea. The largest Pentecostal church, the largest Presbyterian church, the largest Methodist, I'm sorry, 3, largest Methodist church. And there's another Presbyterian church that also is one of the largest churches. I believe 3 of them are in Africa, and 3 of them are in Latin America, and 1 other in Asia, I believe in Singapore. So what we're talking about is the rapid growth of churches in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, reflected in the size of the churches, but also the growth of the church cumulatively in these areas and regions. Now, again, most of this information is pretty set. Number of scholars, kind of church historians now are looking at this, not just missiologists, but church historians are looking back in the last 70 years and said this is some massive changes that are occurring. The bulk of my research has been the changes that are occurring globally, are they also occurring locally? Meaning within the United States and within American Christianity, are there changes that are occurring that reflect the changes that are happening globally? So so this is the second part of it. One aspect of the changes across the United States is just changes in the demographics of America, period, right? So those things are going to be correlated. The changes in American the demographics of America is going to be reflected in the church and vice versa. So let's take a look at first at the demographics of American society. This is Philip Jenkins. Jenkins notes that there was a change in 1965 and that the change in immigration laws in 1965 may be the most significant historical event of that decade. Now think about the power of that statement, because what happened in the 60s? You had anti-war, you had feminist revolution, you had Vietnam War, you had a civil rights movement. You had all these kind of massive social cultural changes. And Jenkins argues that the most significant one actually might be the change in immigration laws. And what Jenkins notes is because of that moment, ethnic character of the U.S. will become less European and less white, and all that it implies for religious and cultural patterns. So this is an interesting statement by Jenkins because he doesn't make a value statement yet. But some interesting things started coming up. 1965, the immigration laws change in the United States. Now, one thing that needs to be explained is that in 1965, what did not happen was throwing the doors open and saying, let's let everybody and anybody in. That has never happened in U.S. history. I'm sorry, it happened one time. That was when the Native Americans saw the Mayflower coming and said, yeah, let's throw the doors open and let anybody and everybody in. That's the one time that's happened. 1965 is not one of those moments. What happened in 1965 was a pretty basic thing. Prior to 1965, for about 100 plus years, there were pretty explicit racist laws in the books of the American government. The first of these was something called the Chinese Exclusion Act. Can anybody guess what that might have done? Yes, it excluded Chinese people. They weren't even playing around at that point. Yeah, we don't want Chinese. What should we call it? Let's call it the Chinese Exclusion Act. Why not? Who's going to argue with us? So that was one of the first acts that said, we don't want a particular group of people to come to the United States, so we'll pass a particular ban on a particular group of people so they can't come into our country. I'm glad we don't do that anymore. But what you see in the Chinese Exclusion Act is the beginning of a series of laws that said we will exclude certain people, especially those outside of Europe. So these laws, like or something called the Gentlemen's Agreement between Japan and the United States, which said, yeah, we'll take a few Japanese immigrants, but they have to be doctors and lawyers and professionals and medical, you know, medical doctors and PhD students, etc. So what you begin to see leading up to 1965 is a ban and an exclusion of non-European immigration. As part of the civil rights movement, this act in 1965 was saying we can't have these racist laws on the book that determines immigration purely on the basis of race and country of origin. That's not who we are as a nation. And so what 1965 did was not fling the doors open and let anybody and everybody in. What it actually did was change the shape of the pie of those who were coming into the United States. So not the shape of the pie, the distribution of the pie. So you don't go from 50 immigrants in 1964 to 6 million immigrants in 1965. You go from 200,000 to 220,000. You go from 220,000 to 250,000. Gradual incremental increases. But what dramatically changes is the distribution. What had been mostly a European and North American phenomenon now actually shifts to much more of a Latin American, particularly Central America, and also a Asian phenomenon. So again, it's not that we flung the doors open and let anybody and everybody in. It was a gradual change so that the distribution of immigrants began to change so that you are actually beginning to see the influx of different immigrant groups. So 1965 is the change in immigration laws. Over the next several decades, even into today, you see the influx of non-white immigrants. So that this gradual increase does culminate in 2008 with the U.S. minority population already at 33% ethnic minorities. By 2011, this is actually one of the most significant landmarks. Half of all the births in the United States are of non-European descent. This is huge. Now, here's why it's huge. 5 years after the birth rate changes, what changes? Of course, the incoming kindergarten class changes, because you had 5 years earlier a birth rate, and now, 5 years later, you have the incoming kindergarten class be 50% ethnic minorities. This only speeds up so that by 2023, 4 years from now, all the children, everyone under the age of 18, will be those of non-European descent. That's a huge landmark. Now, and then, again, these numbers change here and there, but the expectation is within a year or two, maybe 2 or 3 years, by 2042, half of the entire U.S. population will be of non-European descent. A couple of things, especially for educators to look at. This number is very significant. 4 years from now, you will have the majority of children be of non-European descent. In a couple of decades, the majority of Americans will be of non-European descent. This is something that I speak, and when I say this, I usually don't get invited back. But what I will say to the students when I speak at Christian colleges is that I hope you're getting a 2040 education and not a 1965 education. Because if your education is teaching you what is relevant for 1965, mainly a middle-class, white, male, suburban education, you're getting a 65 education and not a 2040 education. So I say, you should go to your bursar and say, I want to pay 1965 tuition because you're giving me a 1965 education. You want to prepare your students for this reality, not for that reality. And you want to prepare yourselves as an education institution for this massive influx of non-white students over the next 10, 20 years. Here's part of the problem. I have been to too many Christian schools over the last 30 years. I've been speaking in a lot of Christian schools. I have been to too many Christian schools where they are not ready at all for this reality. So about 10 years ago, I was at this fairly prominent, well-known Christian college. They had about 2,000 students. They were about 95% white. Actually, this is about 15 years ago, sorry. And I said to them, if you don't kind of change some of the things that you're doing, you will not survive. Now, about 7, 8 years later, I was asked to come back. And I came back, and I noticed that they were still 95% white, but they were no longer 2,000 students. They were at 700 students because they had completely ignored these realities. Now, a couple of things to note here. The change in the demographics of American society is not pegged to immigration. It is pegged to birth rates. So no matter what the speech is about tonight, I guarantee you that these realities will happen no matter what we do with our immigration policy, because this is based upon birth rates. Unless you want to start killing off children, this is a birth rate issue, not an immigration issue. The Browning of America is a birth rate issue. So I've been kind of saying tongue in cheek, I don't want to build a wall, I want to build a dome. I want to seal off the United States of America. I want Canada to pay for this dome. We're going to seal it off. Nobody's getting in or out. This will still happen, because this is what is driving the change, not immigration, but birth rates. And so here's kind of a statistic that the Pew Research Foundation, a fairly conservative think tank, said that from 2009 to 2014, the net loss of Mexican immigration was 140,000. So is there a crisis of illegal immigration? Well, it's debatable. Because about 20, 30 years ago, when we started using that term, maybe longer, the number that was tossed around was about 12 million illegal immigrants in the United States. What's the current estimate of illegal immigrants in the United States? About 11 million. Is that a crisis? Was that?
30 million.
That is a contested figure. The actual numbers that are put forth, not by Fox News, not by other kind of, but the actual numbers that have been put out there is more like 11 to 12 million. Now again, it's a contested number. What I'm saying is that we're not looking at a huge crashing of the border by illegal immigrants. That's not what's actually happening. That's not the reality. That's fake news to say there's a whole rush of hordes. You know what drives immigration? Economics. That's why during this period you see a net loss of immigration, because the Mexican economy is actually doing fairly well. So people don't need to come to the U.S. to find jobs. They're finding jobs in Mexico. That's what drives immigration. So this idea of illegal immigrants rushing the border, that is not the actual reality of the world that's going on right now. Because the changes that we're seeing in the demographics of American society, once again, is not based upon immigration, it is based upon birth rates. And because birth rates are driving this, no matter what policy we have, it is not going to change the reality that you have to deal with as an educational institution. Now, here's the other interesting part of all of this. The other interesting part is when you have this influx of non-white immigrants and the changing demographics of American society, one of the important questions is, well, what happens to the church? what happens to Christian colleges. The first theory that came up was put forth by Diana Eck, who teaches at Harvard University. She was given a $1 million grant by the National Endowment of the Humanities to study this phenomenon of immigration and the changing religious pattern around immigration. Her thesis was that the more immigrants we get, the less Christian this nation will be. She got $1 million to study this. I don't know what she did with $1 million, but she didn't do research because her numbers are just garbage. Her research is just garbage because it turns out her thesis that the more immigrants we get, the less Christian we will be is actually the opposite has occurred. The more immigrants we get, the more Christian America has been because the number of white Christians is just dropping and the number of immigrant Christians is going higher and higher. So what we're seeing are these countervailing trends, and I'll explain these countervailing trends. This is the work of Stephen Warner, University of Illinois Chicago professor, who essentially said Diana Eck's hypothesis is just completely off the wall. He says that the new immigrants that we're seeing post-1965 represent not the de-Christianization of American society, but the de-Europeanization of American Christianity. Think about those words for a moment. The narrative that has been out there has been, well, the more immigrants we get, X hypothesis, the less Christian we'll be, because they're going to be Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. That is partially true, because 20 years ago, you didn't have a Buddhist temple in your neighborhood, and you might. And 20 years ago, you didn't have a Muslim study center in your neighborhood, but you might now. And you didn't have a Hindu temple in your neighborhood, but you might now. But here's what Eck missed. She focused so much on the Buddhist temple in her neighborhood and said, oh, look, there are 50 people going to this Buddhist temple. It's the de-Christianization of America. But what does she miss? The 15 Korean churches that started at the same time, the 5 Chinese churches that started at the same time, the 5 Vietnamese churches that started at the same time, the 2 Karen churches that started at the same time. That's what got missed in all of this conversation, because what they failed to see is not the de-Christianization of America, but the de-Europeanization of American Christianity. The new immigrants make it decreasingly plausible for Americans to think of Christianity as a white person's religion. American Christians and American congregations are increasingly people of color. So what we're seeing then is this countervailing trend. You have the sharp decline, same thing with global Christianity, the sharp decline of white Christianity, both first in the mainline and now in the evangelical churches, and the sharp increase of immigrant and minority and multi-ethnic churches. Those numbers are the ones that are going up. So I had it up earlier. What you saw is actually North American Christianity relatively flat, right? It didn't decline sharply like Europe. It was relatively flat. And the reason it's relatively flat is because of immigration and the children of immigrants. I was at a conference on immigration several decades ago, actually, almost 10, 15 years ago. And this is when actually Bush was president, and McCain and Kennedy were proposing a bill to do comprehensive immigration reform, and they asked some clergy to come and have some discussions about this issue. And one of the conversations was a denominational leader, actually, not from the Wesleyans, but from that tradition, the holiness tradition. It was a pretty large, well-known denomination. If I said the name of the denomination, you would know it. And he said something very fascinating. He said, if you look at our numbers, it looks relatively flat. Right? Like it's a straight line. We're at 15%, 15%, 15%. But if you look at the mainline church's number, what do they look like? They look like they're just hemorrhaging membership, and they are. In fact, their loss of membership is about at a rate of 25% of members every 10 years. That's atrocious, and it keeps getting worse and worse. But the evangelical numbers are evangelical denominations are relatively flatline. If you look at the mainline churches, they're on a sharp decline. Evangelical numbers are relatively flatline. He admitted to this group of leaders that, however, if our flatline numbers, if you take out the immigrant and ethnic churches, our numbers look just as bad as the mainline churches. And so evangelical churches, especially because of the influx of non-white immigrant evangelicals, those numbers look relatively stable because of the influx of immigrant communities. I don't have that statistic with me right now, but the work of Dave Olson seems to indicate that the immigrant churches are propping up the numbers of evangelical churches. Not in decline because of the immigrant churches. That decline is pretty well documented now. the category that many of you are probably familiar with now called spiritual but not religious. It is unquestionably the fastest growing religious identification in America. I believe in 1990 that number was about 4%. Currently the number is at 20%. That is astronomical change in only about 25 years. To go from 4% of U.S. to 20% of the U.S., that is an astronomical change. Now, this was kind of an interesting sociological conversation that was happening, because that number, that increase in spiritual but not religious, was contradictory to a lot of Barna and Gallup's number. So Barna and Gallup at the beginning of this millennium were claiming that about almost half of Americans typically go to church on a Sunday. Gallup's numbers were as high as 60%. And those were numbers that were floating around. 50 to 60% of Americans go to church on Sunday. What Dave Olson and his work in American Church in Crisis found out is that when Barna and Gallup call, people lie. So Gallup for a long time was hitting the mark on presidential election. They were really good about presidential elections. So it turns out that people will not lie about who they voted for, but they will lie about whether they went to church or not. That's kind of the thing that they would do. It's called the halo effect. They will lie to make themselves look good for whatever reason. So you'll call them up. Who did you vote for? They'll tell you. Well, did you go to church on Sunday? They'll say, yeah, sure, I went to church. And so these numbers are highly, highly inflated. So what was done was the approach called headcounts, to say, let's actually just add up the attendance numbers from all the churches that are being reported. Now, I was a pastor. Those numbers are probably inflated too. Come on, let's be honest here. You know, if there were 297 people at the church, how many did I report? Of course, 300. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, they all count. Those numbers might be slightly inflated. But using actual headcount numbers, not self-reported by phone calls, Olson found that only about 17.5% of Americans are going to church. Now, that sounds, to be honest with you, more realistic. So if you've ever been out on the highway at like 10 in the morning on your way to church, do you really believe half the Americans are out there driving to church? If they are out there, they're going to the mall, they're going to the football game. Do you really think 40% of Americans are out there driving to church on a Sunday morning? Or does the 17.5% number look more accurate and realistic? These are the numbers, again, of Dave Olson, which is showing the very sharp decline in kind of American church participation over the last 50 years. This is really actually indicative, according to PRRI, of white evangelicalism in particular. Now, Mark Sheves, a sociologist at Duke University, was actually examining the decline of the mainline church. Mark was one of my professors, and he really looks at the mainline church because of the Methodist affiliation with Duke. And what Mark was noting was that there was a time when the mainline churches just went like that, just kind of dropped through the floor. And what was happening in the mainline church is that they were going in two different directions. One, they were going outside the church altogether. They were just leaving the church, and they stopped going to church. But there was also a significant percentage of mainliners who ended up in the evangelical church. Some of that was white flight. They were leaving the urban centers with these huge Lutheran and Methodist churches. They were moving out to the suburbs and not starting Lutheran and Methodist churches. They were joining the Willow Creeks and the Saddlebacks. So they were kind of converting from the mainline church to the evangelical churches. So you had two exit points for mainliners, and that led to the numbers I gave earlier, 25% of membership being lost. The evangelicals are now experiencing the same decline that the mainlines were experiencing 20 years ago. But here's the problem. The evangelicals are just leaving the church altogether. They're not going to find new churches. That's a small percentage. They're not going back to the mainline. That also is a very small percentage. They are leaving in almost the same numbers as the mainline saw decline 20 years ago. The evangelicals are experiencing that decline. Again, they're just leaving the church altogether. They are what we now call the nuns and the duns. They're never gone to church, or they're just done with the church. So that's a significant change. And you can see this. The percentage of those who identify, who are white, who are evangelical, in 11 years, you can see this precipitous drop. And that's what I mean by the countervailing trends, the sharp decline of white evangelical Christianity, and the sharp increase of multi-ethnic or immigrant-based Christianity. You see this from another angle. The large and growing denominations are Baptists and Pentecostals, which tend to be much more diverse. Now, this is a little bit skewed in that, you know, you get all the Baptists in one room, massive confusion, but what you will have is a pretty diverse group. But it would include the Southern Baptists, which is mostly white, but the National Baptist, which is African-American, and the Progressive Baptist, African-American. But in the aggregate, Baptists and Pentecostals are much more diverse, and they tend to be the growing denominations. The smaller and declining denominations tend to be mono-ethnic, overwhelmingly white. Lutherans, 96% white, they are in sharp, sharp decline. I don't know who the 4% non-whites are in the Lutheran church. I haven't met them yet, but apparently they're there. The 11% non-whites in the Congregational, I don't know who they are, but what you're seeing is this sharp decline or the smaller shrinking of these denominations that tend to be overwhelmingly white. Another kind of study by PRRI, the aging of the white evangelical population. By 2017, those who identified as evangelicals, whites only made up 51%. And so non-white evangelicals already are at the 50% threshold by 2017. Probably within, by 2020, that's going to actually cross that threshold. So if you're talking about how do we identify our student population and the growing population of, you know, I'm not saying that you're all identifying as evangelicals, but those who had kind of carried that label for years, using more theological categories, not social political ones, but carrying that label, where are the evangelicals going to be coming from? From the majority culture, what is not going to be a majority culture, non-white evangelicals. Again, the aging of white evangelicals or white Christians. All American median age is 47. Evangelical median age is 53. If you break that down even further, the median age for white evangelicals is 56. The median age for black evangelicals is 50. The median age for Hispanic evangelicals is 40. And the median age for Asian Pacific evangelicals is 40. Again, if you're looking at the future and saying, what population do we need to fill our campuses that are Christian, this is the group that you're going to need. Not this group. This is the group that you're going to need. Let me get a time check here. How are we doing? We got about 10 minutes left? All right, let's pause and take some questions, and then I don't know if I'm going to get to the concepts, but I'll try to introduce that at the end to have a little more robust conversation. Yeah. Yeah, Canada is interesting because you are seeing a huge influx of Asians, right? So Canada has a slightly different trajectory. They have a larger Native American First Nations population. Now, I don't know Canada as well, but I've taught at Regent and I got some snapshots. So I taught at Regent about 15 years ago, and all my students were white, maybe one or two Asians in that group. I taught at Regent about 2 years ago. There were maybe three white students and 20 to 25 non-white students. So again, that's where the church is. So if you go to Vancouver, for example, the historic white churches are dead. They're kind of non-existent. What you will see is a proliferation of Chinese Canadian churches. Same thing in Toronto. So that kind of immigration has met similar trend lines, but you also have slightly different kind of narratives around Christianity in Canada. Are you Canadian? Or yeah, so I mean that's where some of that narrative of kind of Christianity as a Christian institution is slightly different, right? I mean it's similar to, you know, I was in Australia over the summer, last summer, and they had a very different narrative around Christianity and their country, right? Which is very different in the U.S. compared to Canada. So that would be one factor. You didn't have a huge Canadian Christian population that's in as much of a decline as in the U.S., where you had a huge U.S. white Christian population that is now in decline. But what you are seeing is very similar trend lines. The existing white Canadian churches are in decline, and the numbers are being buttressed by immigrant churches, mainly Chinese. Yeah. Yeah.
North Park, what is the racial makeup of North Park?
Yeah, we passed the 50% threshold about 5 years ago. Now, we have a huge advantage. We are in the city of Chicago, and we are in a neighborhood, a 60625 zip code, that is, I believe, either the first or the second most diverse in all of Chicago. Chicago is fairly segregated, but there are kind of these couple of pockets, and North Park is one of those pockets where it is racially very integrated, and also religiously very integrated. The elementary school that my kids went to had 50 different languages, 75 different people groups.
What did you do to have that?
I think one of the things, and I'm not in the administration, so, and I think we're still a work in progress, is actually be much more intentional about identifying our urban Chicago identity. Now, I know that we're a little bit different in that we there is a faith Christian requirement for faculty and staff. We actually don't require that for the student body. And because of that, I think we've been able to be maybe a little more effective in recruiting kind of non-Christian but different diverse ethnicities, different religions even. Probably the fastest growth rate, and this reflects the numbers I showed earlier, is among Latino students, Hispanic students. And Latino students, oftentimes they're first-generation college students, so you have to kind of work at retention because, you know, that's kind of tends to be the retention problem with those who are first-generation immigrant families. Retention tends to be one of the issues. But the intention was to be more intentional about recruiting urban Latino students. And there's a lot of pipelines in our urban center. So to be honest, we've really benefited from being in Chicago, and that's where the growth edge has been for us. Yeah.
I had a chance to interview Linda Brown from Brown versus Board of Education.
Wow.
And she said something really interesting that I'd love to pick your brain about how you see this translating for Christian colleges and universities. She said that one of the errors that her family found in the civil rights movement, particularly with integration of public schools, was that the change happened with students.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, she felt like it should have happened with staff, teachers, and administrators instead of students.
Yeah, yeah.
And so with that context in mind, how did you see that playing out with our Christian schools? Because more often than not, the schools that I help to support and that kind of thing, there's a sense in which we're starving students.
Yeah.
We get more students of color and more diversity there, but the staff and faculty, there's not that change.
Yeah, yeah.
So how would you engage that comment she made?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, unfortunately, but in my first book, Next Evangelicalism, I actually addressed this in terms of seminary education. And I was noting that, again, these numbers are going to be off. I think it was like at that point, this is about 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, I think it was like 30 to 35% of the evangelical seminary student body were people of color, which is pretty high back then, but only about 20% of faculty and staff were people of color. So there was that pretty significant disconnect between faculty and number of faculty and staff. So that the reason there is twofold. One, an African-American PhD maybe doesn't want to go to seminary for slave wages. Sorry, for like ridiculous wages that seminary pretends to pay. So, you know, that would be one thing. So, I mean, you have some incredible African-American scholars, some of whom are my professors, who, why would they teach at North Park when Duke offers them a position? So, you know, Jay Carter was one of my professors, graduated from Dallas Theological Seminary. His wife's father, was the first African-American professor at Dallas Theological Seminary. But why would he go to Dallas when he has a tenure position track at Duke? Same thing with Willie Jennings, went to Calvin College, Fuller Seminary. He could probably teach at Fuller at the drop of a hat, but he's now at Yale. So why would, you know? So that's one factor that we have kind of top-notch scholars of color who, when given the opportunity to go back to a small Christian college versus teaching at, you know, at a top-notch institution, research institution, will end up at these research institutions. So that's one factor. The other factor is the inability to, and so tied into that is the inability to retain those who came up through that system. That's something that I'm personally passionate about. Over the years, I've had the real pleasure and joy, mainly because I was a pastor in Cambridge and also the context I'm in now, of seeing probably about 10 people of color that I've worked with who ended up with doctorate degrees, about five of whom have ended up teaching. Gordon Conwell, Biola, I'm trying to think of the others, Denver Seminary, North Park. So I've seen that it's possible to raise up people of color to teach and think about teaching at Christian institution, whether it's a seminary or a Christian university. But there has to be some intentionality behind it, and I don't see a whole lot of that intentionality. And so one of the things that we did at, and this is something that I think might be helpful, and I don't want to jump the gun here, but in terms of the denomination, we did a very small thing at our small church, relatively small church in Cambridge. I met a Wheaton College student, African-American, and I met him when I spoke there, and he said, I'm getting ready to go to Fuller and start my theological studies. And I said, how would you like to get a free ride at Gordon-Conwell? I had no money, but I just made that promise. And he said, well, my wife is also going to a seminary. Can she come too? Okay, fine. So his wife is actually Puerto Rican-American. He's African-American. He said, all right, you come to Gordon-Conwell. You intern at my church. We will pay for your seminary education. We'll figure other things out for housing. We'll figure that out. And we did figure that out. But we'll pay for your education. But we want you to be, both of you, to be part of our church community. So what that did was to give, and both are from urban neighborhoods. Vince actually grew up in St. Louis, in a tough neighborhood in St. Louis. And he, after that, finished his MDiv, he was able to go get a THM at Princeton. Why? Because he didn't have $100,000 in loan and debt coming out of seminary. So he goes and does a THM at Princeton, and then he finishes up with a PhD at Catholic University. So he has a degree from Wheaton, from Gordon-Conwell, from Princeton, and from Catholic University. And in fact, as far as I know, he's the only African-American studying early African theology, as far as I know. It was kind of within that guild. But it was a very small sacrifice by one local church to invest in one student and to say, even if it helps just a little bit, for 3 years to not come out of a seminary education with, $50,000 in loans, that's a huge, huge step forward to be able to say, well, then, yeah, I can get a loan for do my THM. Yeah, I can get a loan for do my... So I would love to see denominations make some of that effort, some local churches make some of that effort to say, and we know this, an African-American scholar, a Latino scholar who has great potential to be faculty, some of them can't because of financial restrictions. They're the first to get a college education or a master's degree. To go on to a doctorate is a strain on their family of origin oftentimes. You say, look, we've already paid for 7 years of education for you. You want to do another six or seven? That's a huge strain. So what's the investment that a denomination or an institution or even local churches could make to foster that? So that would be the other part of it. There's no plan of figuring out ways to raise up faculty and staff of color. Maybe one more question before we break. All right, let me offer this conceptualization piece, and then we'll... I want to talk about how change doesn't just come out of an individual change, but out of a social structural change. This is the work of Peter Berger and Thomas Luckman. And Berger and Luckman were trying to say, how do you change social systems and structures? The main way that evangelicals in particular have thought about change is through the individual. Change the individual, change the world. Some good socioanalysis on this was done by Michael Emerson and Christian Smith. Michael is my provost at North Park University, but in their book, Divided by Faith, he notes something called the miracle motif among white evangelicals. The idea that if you simply change individuals, you can change the world. And 99.9% of the time, that's not the way change occurs. Change occurs both on the individual level and on the system structural level. But I'm going to add another wrinkle, and some of you might not even believe me on that, but I want to add another wrinkle here. It's not just individual change that needs to occur, and it's not just social structural change that needs to occur. There are larger powers and principalities that also need to be addressed. So yes, how do you change the world? By raising up good individuals who can change the world, but that's not enough. How do you change the world? By addressing this evil that is in the social structures and systems of the world. But I'm going to argue that that's not enough. Because even if you keep tearing down broken systems, if you don't deal with what drives those systems in the first place, this is the theological concept, then you will end up with a system that keeps reinventing itself. So here's an example of this. We had an atrocious system in America called slavery. And through slavery, there was a tremendous oppression and a dehumanization of African lives. And thank the Lord, we had a civil war and a 13th Amendment to tear down the system of slavery. And so the system, the unjust system of slavery, was torn down. But what we have to realize is that every system has a fuel that drives that system. And the fuel that drove the system of slavery was not addressed even as the system was being torn down. Walter Wing calls these the narratives, the mediating narratives. There's different language around this. The social imagination, the theological imagination, Christian imagination, according to Willie Jennings. Lakoff uses the language of metaphors. Imaginative narratives that drive the system. And if we don't address these narratives, the systems reinvent themselves. So yes, we tore down the system of slavery, but because the narratives, the fuel that drove the system in the first place, was still there, what happened? Well, a new system rose up to take the place that was torn down earlier. And that was Jim Crow. And what you have with Jim Crow feeding on this dysfunctional narrative is maybe not as effective as slavery, but pretty darn awful. So you created a system that built on the fuel, was built on the fuel that was never addressed in the first place. Now, again, that system and structure, praise the Lord, was torn down because we had a civil rights movement, the Voting Rights Act. And so we had that system torn down. But once again, if you didn't deal with the narrative that fueled this system and fueled this system, and the narrative still continues on its way, a new system will take its place. And the new system is the new Jim Crow, which creates a two-tier system within American society right now. Now, every Monday in the semester, I visit Stateville Prison. Stateville Prison is the maximum security prison that is within about an hour of Chicago. So most of the Chicago felons end up at Stateville. I teach a master's level class there with about 20 students. Some of the best students I've had, by the way, have been these Stateville students. It's unbelievable, the level of discourse, the intellectual capacity, the incredible spirituality that comes out in this class that I teach. In fact, I co-teach this. I teach this where about 15 of the students are what we call inside students, Stateville students, and 5 of the students are outside students, so students from North Park who drive down with me to teach this, to take this class. I have no problem saying this. The inside students far are superior in their wisdom, knowledge, and even writing than the outside students. Because they don't have computers, they handwrite every single paper. And I noticed that, wow, there's not even a single scratch out in any of the papers they submit to me. And I realized because they write them over and over again to have perfect, pristine handwritten papers to hand to me. Like 20 handwritten pages. This is the level of commitment that they have to theological education. Now, you know, I get computer typed papers all the time with like massive amount of typos, who don't realize that that squiggly line means that there's a spelling error. They don't even bother spell checking, and I'm getting 20 handwritten pages without a single mistake on any of them. What I've seen though is that the overwhelming, and I'm talking about 95% of the student body, is African American. I'll have, you know, 15 students, 13 African Americans, one white student, and one Latino student. The overwhelming percentage of students are African American. And when I hear their stories, I realize just how much the new Jim Crow is creating a two-tier system. And so because we never dealt with the fuel that drove the problem in the first place, we keep creating new systems and structures that meet the narrative that drives it in the first place. So one of the questions to ask is, what are the narratives that are the dysfunctional narratives within your structures and systems? That even as you try to change the system, if the narrative goes on its merry way, if you don't deal with the systems and structures and the narratives, then a new system will rise up to take the place to fulfill the narrative that is dysfunctional in your midst. I'm sorry, what is our time check here? We end in 5 minutes? 3:45. 3:45 is 5 minutes ago? We're supposed to end at 3:30? Or 3:45? Breaks at 3:45, and it's 3:30 now. Okay. Let me give you one example, and then I'll open it up for maybe 3 minutes of questions. One example is, are there narratives that elevate certain people group over and against the other? So when I talk about the new Jim Crow, and I go to Stateville, the narrative that I found that led to 95% of African Americans in my classroom is that black bodies are inferior to white bodies, and that black minds are inferior to white minds, and that if you have a black body, then it is much more disposable than a white body. A fairly recent case where a white person who committed a very horrible sexual crime the judge actually said, well, you have more potential, so we're going to give you a lighter sentence. This is not an uncommon narrative that I've heard within the students that I've dealt with. One of my students is at the age of 16, 17, it occurred when he was 16, but he was jailed when he was 17, had an abusive stepfather. He left the home to get away from his abusive stepfather, abusive particularly towards his mom. That abusive stepfather was involved in drugs and gang violence, and eventually he was killed in a drug deal that went wrong. The guy that shot him was actually was a drug dealer, and there was this beef, and Eric's stepfather was killed. The guy that shot him said that he was hired by Eric to kill his stepfather. Now, Eric graduated from high school at the age of 16. By 19, he was getting ready to graduate from DePaul University. So he was arrested at 17. Let me get the numbers right. Arrested at 17, and then with the trial and everything, he was jailed at the age of 19, before he was 19, right at the cusp of him graduating from DePaul with a bachelor's degree. Now, it all comes around because he's now in the Northwestern program to get his bachelor's degree. Eric was arrested based upon the testimony of the actual shooter. He was sent away for 40 years, and he's still in prison today. There was testimony after testimony that said Eric was never near that place. They don't know each other, but because of the shooter's testimony. By the way, the shooter's out. Got out after 15 years. Eric's still in prison after 25 years. So when you think about these kind of realities, that a honor student who graduated high school early and was about to graduate college at the age of 19, 20 years old, his life was deemed unredeemable. That was the narrative that was in place. Those are the questions that I began to ask when I began to encounter these incredible stories from these students. One of the questions I ask is, how then do we reflect this, that the value of white bodies and the value of white minds, or the product of white minds, is superior to the product of others? So, for example, how do we view culture? This is the work, by the way, of, I can't remember the author, Myers, I think it was Myers. He wrote a book called All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes. First book I read in seminary, I almost dropped out of seminary after I read this book. He created these categories of culture. He graded culture. He said there's a high culture, and this is how he described high culture. Ballet, Shakespeare, Rembrandt, Downton Abbey. No, I just made that one up. You get the idea. European culture was considered high culture. And the way Myers described European culture is that European culture was a higher culture, but it could hold virtue for longer periods of time than other forms of culture. Then he created a second grade called low culture. And he identified things like television sitcoms and Andy Warhol's paintings and pop music as low culture. Now, one of the things to note is that when he created these two categories, high culture and low culture, all the examples were actually Western cultural examples, right? So you had Shakespeare versus Britney Spears. Well, with that comparison, I can kind of go with, yeah, Shakespeare is probably high culture and Britney Spears is probably low culture. But what did he do? He left out 99% of the cultures in the world. So he created a third category called folk culture. And into the category of folk culture, he put African-American spirituals, Native American regalia, Korean fan dancing and drumming rituals. All of that got placed into folk culture, and he identified folk culture as lower than European high culture and said that folk culture does not have the capacity that high culture has to express virtue. This is the gradation of culture. Now, what I'm pointing out is, you might say that's silly, or you might say that's true. The point is that you are buying into a narrative that says European expressions of culture, intellect, academics, is superior to all other forms. And that narrative gets embedded into the mindset of educational institutions. So that if someone is coming from here, I'm not even talking about here, if someone is coming from here, there is an automatic assumption that their reality is inferior to the reality of high culture or the education of high culture. So are these narratives embedded into our systems in such a way that even if we say, well, we're going to accept more ethnic minorities into our Christian institutions, if this narrative is still there, those minorities will not be around for much longer. They will feel hostility. They will feel discomfort. They will feel their identity being challenged on a constant basis. So those who are here will say after a while, why am I here? My identity is not being affirmed here. I'm being told I'm inferior to a superior culture that is represented by the dominant culture. Question is, this is one example. What are the narratives that are embedded within the system that actually creates a system and structure of hostility? And even if you tear down one system and structure, other systems and structures keep taking the place because you're not dealing with the narratives that drive these systems. I think we got 30 seconds for questions. How about this? I'll dismiss. I'll be around during the break to answer any questions, maybe in person, for about 15 minutes, and then we'll take. I'll need a 15-minute break for the next session. Thank you for your attention. I know this is not the easiest content. I just pray that you would actually grapple with the content of what I'm saying, and maybe not my delivery or my kind of flipping comments along the way. But please think through the content of what we've been talking about. Thank you for your time today.